All right, thank you all for showing up. And since this is a lot about languages and words and sometimes heady stuff, I like starting out with the singing bowl as a reminder of another language that's beyond the words. And I also like to start off thanking the earth and the water and the air and the fire. Those are all the elements that help us every day and that are part of us. So let's see, my dad used to say, all you need is one. So when I was a teenager and I'd be whining and complaining, I might be looking for a job. I don't remember exactly, but I might've tried 10 places and I'd be all bummed out and he'd be like, all you need is one. And that would spark my, that would turn my energy around. So that's what it, the reason being here tonight is Mindy's the one, because we were having conversations just casually while working on the book project. And I would tell her little anecdotes about, you know, oh, I learned this about a native language and this is fascinating. And she's like, she became very fascinated with it. So after however many conversations, I shared a film with her too. I think it's called The Language of Spirituality.
Yeah, that was great.
Good film about language, the quantum physics of native languages. And then eventually she asked me if I would give a talk about, you know, native languages. And I'm like, well, I'm not native for one. And number two, I don't feel like I have the creds to talk a whole talk about native language. But then I thought about it. And I'm like, well, what if that's part of it? I can share little bits that I've learned and then broaden it to languages in general. So that's where the basic idea comes from. As the title suggests, there's two basic threads of enhancing your writing and your lifestyle. So I'm just going to talk about a lot of different stuff, give some examples. It'd be like a journey through history and languages, different examples, and then some of it, not an exact science. Sometimes I wander in different directions. But generally it's to, you know, certain things may pique your interest, like, wow, that's fascinating consciousness-wise, and then other things are also meant to kind of help encourage better writing. One of my theories is that poetry in English, English poets are really striving for a native or indigenous consciousness. And I'll give some examples of why that's my theory, because I think that when I hear how native people describe certain words and in phrases or whatever in their languages, it sounds poetic. In English, you know, these are translations too, to keep in mind, translated into English, but it sounds poetic. So I'm like, wow, they're like speaking poetry in conversation, and here we are like working like crazy to write it. So I think there's something to learn, and I know it enhances my poet, you know, my writing. Let's see. So yeah, I want to start off with a list of greetings as an example of what I'm talking about. These are a bunch of different greetings in different languages that I kind of collected to give the flavor of that. So the first one I learned from a friend, Stephen Newcomb, who I'll quote, he's Shawnee and Lenape. I'll quote him some more probably. It's, I think they're the native people in California, the, hopefully pronounce it right, Kamiye. And they say Hauka, which he said means, may the fire within you burn bright. And then one I learned many years ago from ancient Egyptian is Anitrak, which means homage to thee within. And then most people are familiar, it's kind of become cliche, but it's still beautiful, namaste. It's overused, I think, but still, in essence, it is lovely. Namaste, when I looked it up online, it said bowing or salutation to you. And then I have Punjabi friends, so I learned to say Sat Sri Akal. That's their greeting, like when they have parties or, you know, gatherings. It's, you know, see people and they say that. It's basically truth, great or respectful, and timeless or supreme being, like God or spirit. So Sat Sri Akal, truth, respectful, timeless being. And then another person I'll quote a bunch, Lakota friend. He's he hosts an amazing radio show, First Voices Radio, Teokasin Ghost Horse. That's the radio show's in its like 32nd year, I think. So at the beginning of the show, he'll say something like, and I think a lot of the Lakota and other natives do that when they say, "Greetings, my relatives," meaning like not just the humans, but all peoples, all beings. And I shake your hand with good feelings in my heart. And then one that I heard from the Navajo or the Diné, that's out near where you were in Arizona. I don't know if I can pronounce it. It sounds like Ya Tehe. And I'm not sure of this, but I had heard somebody say it's something like, "Isn't it amazing? Here we are meeting in this place, our feet with the earth and the sky above us." And I was just like wowed by that, because it was like, this huge picture just to say hello, which is amazing. You know, when I think about, I drove over here and how many cars I passed and I got lost and then I found it and then you people showed up. It's just like an amazing thing that we're actually here in this moment. Another one, one of my books, Haiku One Breaths, I got the title from reading that originally haiku perhaps is real short because it was to be what could be expressed in one breath. So from that, I think like maybe people, you know, imagine if you're greeting people or you say hello to people in the morning, but instead you spoke in haiku. So it might be, you know, like cold wind, geese flying south, have a warm day or something like that. Like I think that'd be way more interesting way to converse. And then let's see, Korean, I have some Korean friends. So Annyeong Haseyo, that's how they say hello. I looked that up online. It says it's sort of like hello or good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and perhaps like wishing, like be at peace, so wishing that you're at peace, or asking someone, are you at peace? And then we get to New York. New York, perhaps the most eloquent. How you doing? Yeah, I had to throw that one in there. But then actually the... this one, Steve Newcomb, I checked with him this morning, because more the true New York, the Lenape people, they might say Wanishi, which is thank you. It has like a sense of appreciation to it. So it's not just thank you, it'd be like appreciation in there. And then when I looked up online, it said, may the way be beautiful for you. And also, he said there's something about something reference to like the one who created everything with thought. That might be the creator he was mentioned, but anyway, that the idea of these is to give it like a cultural example of how even a simple thing as such as a greeting can be just such a deep, you know, recognition to people. Oh yeah, and then also a lot of Asian cultures, and I do it too, just like a silent nod or a bow. I'll do that at a stoplight. You know, I look over at a car, and there's an awkward moment. You know, people look at each other, and I give a little nod, and most times people nod back. And I feel like I just, you know, my day expanded because I can, at least there was like this moment with somebody. So it's just, I find that just like an example of, you know, a way to live, and language wise, how there can be so much more put into it than just, you know, hey, how you doing? Good. How are you? No, we tend to be like, good. How are you? Good. Good. Yeah, it's sort of, it can be nice, but it's kind of meaningless after a while. And some people ask how you doing and they don't even, like, they don't really care. Like about the answer. It's just like, how you doing? Yeah. Oh, not so good. All right, have a good day. And it's like, whoa, I just said not so good. But anyway, some people listen. Another thing from my dad is that he had these two words he would always say. It's all about attitude and perspective, which I think is very true. Attitude and perspective. And I was thinking about that further in this context. And I was thinking how perspective shapes attitude and perspective shapes the attitude, and then our actions. I think the official study of this is cognitive science, which I don't know much about, but that might be the official way to approach how the the language, so that's part of what I'm talking about. The language in our consciousness affects our perspective and then how we, who we are and what we think about and what we do and all that stuff. So a lot of people don't realize their names are words too. Like how I like asking people, do you know what your name means? So a bunch of years ago, I actually looked up, my birth name is Walter Edgar Harris. So I looked it up and I did a little, some of the definitions may be like a little bit laced with like some of that may be English or German, and it may be laced with like the sort of, you know, people that, you know, manners and noble and this and armies and stuff like that. So I kind of rephrased it a little to what I think is more of the essence. So it turns out it comes out to peaceful warrior, fortunate spear, protector of the land. So that's, I like that a lot because it reminds me, you know, sometimes someone comes up in the yard, somebody wants to say, hey, let's take that out, it's a weed. I'm like, no, that's a flower or something. So they put my name into action. So yeah, that's a good one way to look up your own, look up your own name and see what it means. Another example, I had interviewed Stephen Newcomb on my podcast a while ago, and we were talking about, he talked about when Columbus first got to, got to the island. There was an island he got to named Guanahani, which was the name of the native people there. But he named it San Salvador, or somebody, maybe him, it became San Salvador, which was like an obvious reference and glorification to Jesus Christ the Savior. So, I mean, you could talk about that for a half an hour, which we did on the podcast, like 15 minutes. In essence, it's an example of how the naming and the words and the label that we put on stuff becomes like an overlay and can totally change consciousness and history and affect everything from then forward. Because who's ever heard of Guanahani? I had never heard of it. And what about the people that were living there for thousands of years? So, you know, it's a huge way that the power of the use of the words. And even around in the United States and elsewhere, think about New York, New Jersey, New England, New Mexico, New Paltz. There's a lot more news. But wait a minute, how are they new when native people have been here for thousands and thousands of years? So again, there's a way we phrase things and label them puts this whole consciousness in perspective that's different than sort of what's actually, it gets our attention away from what's actually going on with the land. At a one library program, there was Chief Harry Wallace from the Unkachak, Puspatuck Reservation. He said that Pominock, which Whitman used in his poems, he said that I think it might be more pronounced like Pomenaki. And he said it means like a sea spirit or land of spirit or island of spirit. So I thought that was interesting. That is interesting. And then the Shinnecock, and I've heard the Settlecot referred to Long Island as Sawanaki or Sawanaki, meaning shell place. So the Aki, both say the Aki is the land or the place. So, and then the shell, that's why I wear this necklace, because it's got the Siwan, the purple shell. So remind me where I am when I'm lost in traffic and it's all, you know, stoplights and cars. It's like, oh yeah, but it's really Sawanaki. So it's probably got other names, but that's, you know, that's some examples of the names and the places. All right, now to start going into this, a little bit of history. Let's see, the letters and the alphabet. So let's see, this is a picture. Anybody want to guess what the picture represents? Very good. Yes, it's the ox. Ox horns. Now, if we turn it upside down, the letter A. Oh. That is where the letter A comes from. The ox, the shape of the ox. And for some reason, which in my research, I could not find out any specific answer, except maybe, you know, things in translation, people are hurrying or doing, I don't know, I didn't find an exact answer of how it got upside down. But I find that extremely symbolic. Beta means house or dwelling place, a container or a house, modern house. So basically, the alphabet as the backbone of the language we speak, we say the alphabet, we're saying ox house, which is also upside down. really, it's upside, we're speaking upside down ox house is how I would say it. So it sounds kind of amusing, but then I thought about it more, and there is some, like I have a reference in the Kabbalah with the ox is like a symbol of, you know, hard work and strength, you know, it's like do work in the fields and stuff. But a lot of the association with ox is domesticated. Think of the ox as a domesticated animal. And you think about, doesn't that describe a lot of America? Domesticated animal house. So again, the language has affected our consciousness and stuff. And then I also, just preparing for this, I thought of the, maybe people are aware of the Plains Indians, how many of the buffalo were slaughtered deliberately by the U.S. Army, maybe, like deliberately to, because that's the, like the core of the Plains Indians culture, the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, the buffalo. And there's a horrific picture of like just heaps of buffalo. So I'm thinking the buffalo is wild. And there is a little bit of a resurgence, you know, they're hanging on in numbers, and it's gone up a little bit. But again, it's reflective of this upside downness that, you know, to me, and some of what I put in the book, The Moving Through the Empty Gate Forest, is like a study of the language and the alphabet and how it came over to this land, Turtle Island, that the natives call, and, you know, wreaked havoc. And so these are some of the examples I'm giving. And also, as a writer and as somebody who speaks English, I also have to appreciate and love the language. And, you know, there's positive things to say about it, but I'm trying to convey it in the bigger picture. So I'm not just like saying it's all bad, but I'm trying to show this bigger picture, how I think the language and the letters is what it represents and how much it's avoided. And that's part of why I think the other languages are so fascinating too, because there's more to them. But yeah, I have a longer essay about that with the upside down ox house, and I go into some more details. But that, yeah, it says a lot to me how much. The other thing I thought about too is how much, like 26 letters, they all have some picture behind them, like door, house, I forgot the whole list. But it's almost like, why did those get picked? How did those pictures become sort of the bare bones of the language? I don't know. It seems like a narrow view that we would pick those pictures, even though like when we speak and talk and read, it's not necessarily, there's a lot more going on, but somehow the backbone of it, or the basic structure of it, is strangely only based on those pictures. So it seems very limiting. One positive example in Hebrew is the, well, I just gave it away before showing the picture, but Mindy probably know that one. The Hebrew letter A, which is above and below and connecting. So I like, you know, I find that a very beautiful letter, because it's a picture, but it also, it's sort of like a doorway or a gateway, because it puts me, you know, when I look at it, it reminds me of like above, whatever above means to you, the sky or the spirit world, and below, the earth. So it helps connect that, like that famous, as above, so below, as below, so above. And then that they're connected too. So I like, you know, I like that as far as a letter. Let's see. And then, yeah, just to give an example of the way the letters have been used. Here's a quote by David Abram in a book, The Spell of the Sensuous. Little pun on with the title there, Spell of the Sensuous. Thus it was that the progressive spread of Christianity was largely dependent upon the spread of the alphabet, and conversely, that Christian missions and missionaries were by far the greatest factor in the advancement of alphabetic literacy in both the medieval and the modern eras. It was not enough to preach the Christian faith. One had to induce the unlettered tribal peoples to begin to use the technology upon which that faith depended. So there's a lot going on there to think about, you know, how the letters and the whole English language then became. It was like a technology before what we think of technology, to then, you know, reshape the thinking and stuff. A lot of these I could go off on book tangents, so I'm trying to focus on it. And that was one that I had heard my friend Tiokasen say, like when he was talking about the Lakota language in a talk, he said something like that the Lakota, they don't need written language. Their language is too big for A to Z. Too big. That just made me go, whoa, wait a second. That's like, you know, as he calls it, like thinking outside the box. Wait a minute, we have this A to Z. It's very hierarchical in a way. You know, you think about, if your name is, your last name is Z, and you're waiting in line, you're going to wait the longest time. So it's very hierarchical. And does anybody ever think, today we're going to start with the P's? No, I don't think I've ever heard that. So there's something about that got me very fascinated with delving into learning more about the alphabet. Was hearing like, wait a minute, there's these people that have been here for 200,000 years, and their language is very deep. So, wow, that got me a lot into thinking about the alphabet and studying a little bit of history. A lot of it goes back. There's a really cool book. It's called Alpha Beta: How 26 Letters Shaped the Western World. And that has a lot of stuff. Basically, it's like, so, you know, the origins are, I forget the exact year, probably like 4,000, 2,000 BC or so, talking about Egyptian hieroglyphs and Phoenician and Hebrew and Greek. Like, if you look up in dictionaries, you'll see the shapes of the letters, and it tells you, shows you some of the evolution and the pictures. But again, that's only like 4,000-6,000 years, however many years. And, you know, a lot of the native cultures go back 10,000 or more. So they have another view and another language of the world. And then another thing I had learned was that, let's see, like, yeah, like 60% of the English is Latin. So that comes from the Roman, a lot of it from the Roman culture, which is like, is a culture of empire. So we're speaking this, you know, language very much of empire rather than of, you know, the elements in the earth. Marshall McLuhan, that's another great book, The Gutenberg Galaxy. He talks about the Gutenberg's press, and he describes how the shift to the alphabet was like going from some sort of magical ear, like, you know, imagine being out in nature and you're having to look and hear things, and all your senses are cranking, and then the alphabet put us into this visual, a very visual consciousness. So, you know, most of our learning and stuff comes from our eyes and looking at the words and letters rather than the deeper experience. And then also with some of the origin of the English, I don't remember what it was, but I was watching a documentary one time on TV, and it mentioned the Frisian, West German language. Does anybody know Frisian? I'd never heard of it. F-R-I-S-I-A-N. And what it said, I found interesting. It cited one of the roots of modern English as Frisian, a West Germanic language. What stood out was the mention of the language reflected the following characteristics: warlike, adventurous, greedy, and religiosity, probably Christendom. Yeah, so I found that very interesting. Like, those characteristics are still what's very much plaguing the world today. Warlike, greedy, religion, you know, Christendom fighting over lands and all that goes with that. Again, another huge tangent. Adventurous, that's sort of positive. Like, but again, I think that's very reflective of, you know, American culture. You know, very much people, it's like, what do we do for some adventure? You know, it's very like, that's the idea of an exciting weekend or a vacation. A lot of times it's adventure, which has its positives, but there's more to it than that that picture. There was one phrase in that I heard, like, it was very poetic. I think it referred to the body as the bone house. So that's poetic. So, you know, even in some of these languages, even if there's I'm kind of highlighting what I see as like a negative energy trajectory, there's going to be some beautiful language if you study it more deeply, because that's a pretty cool, not the most like energizing sense of identifying with the body, but it is like it's a bone house, the bones, and we're here we are for a while. Another one interesting, in Sanskrit, gavisti, however you pronounce it, it's the word for war. In Sanskrit, it means desire for more cows. So that says a lot about the origin of what, again, we're fighting for, and there's the ox again. People fighting over the ox. So a lot of different connecting dots there. All right, let's see. Now we'll get on to, oh yeah, the Chinese. All right, Chinese, because I study brush calligraphy. My mom got me a kit like 30 or something years ago. I was doing calligraphy with the little nibs, metal nibs, and then I got the brush calligraphy kit. At the same time, I was learning about Taoist philosophy and Taoist lifestyle. So I got into learning the Chinese, and that's a picture language. It starts with pictures, like the letters. A couple of ones that I find fascinating. The word to speak is a picture of like two doors, or like those swinging, like those saloon, you know, the little doors are swinging, or a gate, and then a mouth. So when I read that, I'm like, wow, that's like sometimes you open and sometimes you close, sometimes you talk, sometimes you don't. Same thing with the ear. It's the gate, the two little doors, or the ear. Well, sometimes you listen, sometimes you don't. But yeah, that's like a very simplified, but I think it's interesting. This one is peace. This is the original. This is like the modern Chinese. The original, this is the breath. And this is an obstacle. And the breath moves through the obstacle. And then it unites the opposing energies or forces. So I find that a real help. Like a meditative help, or if something, you know, even in a pinch where there's a disagreement or an argument, instead of panicking or freaking out, it's like, take a deep breath and, okay, how do we find the common ground? How do we bring it together? You know, or if you're arguing, you know, with someone, you know, and, you know, you just got to go walk off for a few minutes. That's sort of like I find that a meditative trick to do. And then again, I have to add, Tsiokasen says a lot on his radio show and when he gives talks, peace with earth. You need to have peace with earth. Because it's not just peace, it's like peace with, people say peace, 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 but peace with what? Like you feel good, good, but we need to have peace with the earth, and especially coming up for holiday time, not peace on earth, because that's on is like standing on top of and dominating. Whereas peace with is working together. Or is connecting with, it's feeling and relating. When I go out in the yard at night or whenever and I put my feet, it's like with the grass. And I feel like I'm with the earth, not like I'm standing in the yard or on the grass. So it's definitely like, it's more holistic and helpful. Let's see, from there. Yeah, then from a friend who knew a lot of Greek. And he said, I would always be careful about, you know, I wouldn't call somebody an idiot. It would be kind of derogatory. But then he said from Greek, idiote, it means something like away from or outside of the sanctuary or the sacred space. So I was like, wow, that's the, now I maybe not to write to their face, but I freely use the word idiot now, because it's saying like that person is not being in the sanctuary space. They're being an idiot. You know, like polluting a pond or a river or something, that's being an idiot. One definition, because it's not being with the sanctuary. So that's interesting. There's a lot of, I don't know that much Greek at all. I got some Greek dictionaries because of my friend, but it's hard to get into it sometimes. Then there's a cult, there's a people in the mountains of Colombia and South America, the Kogi. The native peoples, and they have no, I think they're some of the only indigenous peoples to have survived the Spanish conquests. They went up into the mountains and they have no books, and they can read the water. They like read the bubbles. There's a quote, there's a great movie, there's two movies, Luna, Aluna, and the first one is something like Elder Brothers from the Heart of the World. It's a really fascinating documentary. You can probably find them on YouTube if you look them up. It's just fascinating to see these people. But there's a quote from one of those movies, I think, Aluna. Because we do not have writing and are not educated in their schools, younger brother may not believe what we say. They call the other, you know, the white man and other people younger brother. We can see this in the bubbles, like reading a book. It's true. The mother speaks through the bubbles. It's the truth. So that's just amazingly fascinating, because again, there's a whole consciousness of experiences that we have. I think a lot of writers, we try to put into words, you know, what's going on. That's a lot of how I write. I try to like translate my experience and put it into words. Right. But there's also a place where there are, you know, there sort of are no words. You know, you have such a good time. There's a haiku by Basho. It's not like anything they compare it to, the summer moon. It's not like anything they compare it to the summer moon. It's just like, it's so, whatever it is, you can't put it into words. So there's that place too. It's sort of, if you spend too much time there, you know, a writer might be out of a job, but I try to balance my, you know, my writer time and consciousness with that time where there's just like beyond the words. Let's see, what else? Anybody got a question or anything thus far? Some of the native examples I want to give that where I like very poetic. I was saying that before. I saw a Mohawk. He came to Long Island a couple of times. Tom Porter, another guy. If you look up his YouTube, you get some amazing talks he gives. He's Mohawk. I think he's a chief of the Turtle Clan. I'm not sure, or the Bear Clan. But he was describing. He said there's no word for green in their language, the color green. So he said what you would say would be something like, the woman's dress is the color of the grass in springtime, which would be light green. So that to me, that just sounds, not only does the wording poetry, but the rhythm is poetry in English. The woman's dress is the color of the grass in springtime. That's poetry to me. But that's how they, that's their language. I actually kind of like hijacked that, put that in my novella that I'm working on. I wrote, I have this guy that drives an old blue truck. So I don't remember how I got to this, but it's definitely a riff from that. So I repeat this throughout probably about 10 times in the story, in the novella. So I describe it as light blue, like the sky in springtime, 1984 Ford 150. Light blue like the sky in springtime, 1984 Ford 150. Because when I lived in Colorado, a good friend of mine, he had an old Ford truck. And when I was remembering, I remember it was light blue. I'm like, how could I describe it? Like the sky. So that's an example how you can kind of borrow from some of these examples and maybe find a way to enhance your own writing. Yeah.
You and I were talking once about how some native languages make connection to the earth in things where they're not even talking about the earth, but is that kind of at play here? Because the describing the woman's dress, the color of grass, and the truck is the sky, it's rooting it something in the world.
Yeah, that's
outside
right.
Itself.
That's one of the key things too I wanted to say. A lot of these examples is like, a lot of times we use abstract language and we don't know. Like we think we know what it means, but if you stop and ask somebody, they'd probably be like, I don't know. Like, you know, we say love a lot. Like I was, that's one example in my Muses book about the Greek have like eight kinds of love, eight words for types of love. I was telling that to Tonito Valderrama, he's Taino, and he said something very funny. He said, yeah, in English, like you would say, you know, I love you deeply, and I love chicken McNuggets. You would use the same word. but you know, love is beautiful, but you could say I love whatever. That's another one in the Lakota. Tsiokasin says they don't have a word for love. At first it's like, excuse me, what? But it's more like, you are my skin. Something like, you are my skin. Which again is a very visceral, very person connecting, beautiful. I think because if the language, it's like the way the Inuit have like umpteen words for snow.
Yeah.
Then a friend who lives in Hawaii, she's native. And then one time I told her I saw like it rained and I was describing the rain and the rainbow. And she emailed me like, well, can you describe the rain? And then it turned out, I forget the number, but they have like, I forget, it was like 13 or 50 or 100. It was a large amount of ways to describe rain. So I think any place one is, if it's rooted in going back in time in that indigenous way, that the language is going to reflect that. So it is in that way. Something. There's a quote I put in my book. This was Tsiokasin. This is from one of his talks at the COP24 in 2018 in Poland. He gave a talk there. And this is like the deep layer of the indigenous languages. These indigenous languages that are more at risk than ever, that will be almost extinct at the end of the century are the most powerful languages. They speak of quantum physics and how to communicate with Mother Earth. And you can't find them in libraries or on your computers. You have to live them. And if we don't know how to do that, the best way you can do that is not to ask, how do I do this? Because we're so used to the privilege of getting the answer when we have a how to do something. And that manual is not in my back pocket nor yours. So, you know, I can't answer the question there, but there's that, some of that, that movie that you watched, there's that language that's the quantum physics. I mean, you know, Native, they have healing songs. They're like the women, well, I've seen a video on YouTube, like women at the river singing a healing song for the water. So that maybe is an example of that quantum level of, you know, communicating with the nature. Because that's interactive. It's not just describing it. It's not just entertaining a song about water. It's like literally like talking to a loved one or a psychiatrist where you're literally trying to heal. So, you know, that's some deep stuff there. You know, like that's another one in Lakota that Tsiokasen explains about the word mini as, you know, what we would call water. It's like his very loose snippet of a translation is like you and me and that which carries feelings between us and all beings. And that's like their consciousness of water. So that speaks to what you mentioned before about the earth, connection with the earth and the consciousness. But it's like, it's not just the water as a thing out there. It's like the emotion between us. Yeah, some of the other words that he's mentioned about Lakota, like they don't have a word for nature. Because it's like, it's not a thing out there. Like, we are a part of nature, nature's a part of us. No word for free. Because, like, if you already are, like, why would you need a word for it? And then no word for exclusion. That helped me a lot. Because when I heard that, I thought about, you know, certain things would annoy me and somebody, you know, I had to be around a lot. And it was like, I don't want them to be in the picture. And then I heard, oh, in Lakota, they have no word for exclusion. So it made me have to say, okay, how do I include this person in my consciousness in a way that I can at least get along at some level? So that's, you know, that's another example. And then recently I had seen no word, in an article it said, no word for poverty. Oh yeah, no, they told me they don't have a word for poverty, she said. The closest thing they had as an explanation for poverty was to be without family, which is basically unheard of. They were saying it was a foreign concept to them that someone could be just so isolated and so without any sort of a safety net or a family or a sense of kinship that they would be suffering from poverty. So there, yeah, there's another example of the consciousness that comes with the languages. Another one I had just read recently, some African people, I don't know how to pronounce it, ANLO-EWE, the word for walk is more like moving in full-bodied grace. When you think about African people, they like when they walk, you like notice they're like dancing. So, but that's another one. That's along with being beautiful, and that would be how they raise their kids. They're taught to like move in full-bodied grace. So there again, if I as a writer, I'm saying, you know, oh yeah, the character, he walked to the store. It's okay if you want to convey the information, but maybe there's a better way to say it. You know, maybe he moved with full-bodied grace as he went to the store, or if he was awkward or a gawky teenager, you know, it'd be like, he walked like whatever the adjective, you know, something, so you could play on that to enhance your descriptions. So another one I want to mention is time. A lot of the native indigenous languages, they don't have the whole experience and consciousness of life is a whole different time. Like they don't have words for time the way we know it by the clock. So here's a cool book by Evan Pritchard, who's a I'm not sure how to pronounce. I forgot the exact pronunciation. Evan T. Pritchard, No Word for Time, The Way of the Algonquin People. So I'll just read a little bit here. There are words for day and night, one for sunrise, one for sunset, one for lunar cycle, one yearly cycle, youth, adulthood, old age, but no word for an absolute time. which measures the universe from outside of it. The way time is dealt with in Algonquin speech teaches us that time is relative and elusive in nature. Just as Einstein proved and as quantum researchers are discovering, there is no concept of time outside its embodiments in the things of nature. I've heard Mi'kmaq people point to the sky and use the expression, "Where is it now?" meaning, what is the position of the sun? I've even agreed to an appointment to meet an elder when the sun sits, quote, "there above the trees," end quote, but no mention of hours. So you just think about that, like, I'll meet you for coffee tomorrow when the sun is above the harbor, you know, whatever the landmark is. So that's a whole other perception of the world. What was the other one I was reading about? Some other language. I think it was, the Australian Aboriginal peoples. He's got a book called Sand Talk. Tyson Yunkaporta. But he mentioned something in his book about language. It's like, the directions, something about the directions. It would be something about, where's your car? Parked outside? No, it's like northerly or something. Something to do with the references for the directions. So even when you're indoors, you're still connecting with the outdoors because you're thinking in that way. All right, then I wanted to, sort of the last section is to talk about more of the writing, some about writing techniques and how to enhance some of the writing aside from things I've mentioned. So I would say emotion, like for me, the emotion and the sound and the flow of the writing is very important, especially poetry. So one of my big influences with that is Dylan Thomas, as an example. Has anybody read Child's Christmas in Wales? His beautiful booklet. No. You ever seen that? Oh, that's a fabulous book. Child's Christmas in Wales, and the original version has like these little wood block prints. It's like, it's a beautiful, beautiful holiday gift. But the writing, it starts off, it's one of my favorite passages in literature. It starts off, "One Christmas was so much like another. In those years around the sea town corner now, and out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I find." I think he brings out the memories of, he's going to tell the story of growing up and the family and all that. But I just love that. And I love the kind of haze, the mystery of the snow, and I can't remember whether it was 12 nights and when I was 6 or 6 nights when I was 12. It's just, to me, that's just like, it conveys that timelessness, that the mystery of a kid. And kids don't really have a sense of time either. Yeah, they're born with that consciousness. We have that until it's like time to go to school, time to go to work, time to do this, time to do that. It's very, we become programmed by the, not only by the language, but the numbers and the time. Yeah, a couple other things I had learned from a writer a while ago. One thing I learned, the verb to be is a very weak verb. So like a lot of times, the is and are and was and all the conjugations, a lot of times people use it and it's very, there's just other ways to say it. Like when I was thinking of example, it was like if you said the store is opening at 9 a.m. But then if you thought, wait a minute, how else could I say it? You might say the store breathes open at 9 a.m. So wow, there all of a sudden you got like somebody coming to work, taking a deep breath, whatever. So anytime I see is, was, are, were in writing, especially poetry, I'm like, how? Not, it's not an absolute, but I think, how else could I make spice this up? Because, we're used to thinking like, the other one is it. It's a nice day. It is like a nothing word. It's like people say that, use it a lot. It is, I'm trying to think of examples, but it's also, it's used a lot because it's in our conversational language. But again, if you when I see it, I look for another way. What is it? A lot of times, like, it was a dark and stormy night. We know that classic. But what was a dark? Like, it was a dark and stormy night. Actually, describing the dark and stormy night. So what's the it? It sort of doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Well, what's it? So actually, I had that with I was working with a poet, and she won me over because I was pointing them out to her poems, but she wanted to keep a certain amount of the its because she was reflecting the conversational tone. So again, it's not an absolute. Like if you're saying to someone, you know, if you have a character or in a play or a story, and they're saying, it's, you know, it's a nice day, you don't have to try to find a spicy way because that's how somebody might talk. So then you know, so that's why I'm saying it's not absolute, but a lot of times you can spice up the language if you go over what you first write and then say, okay, how can I enhance this? That's another mind blower that I learned from about the Lakota language. They can talk the traditional language. They can talk all day without using nouns, only in verbs. So that's because, I mean, everything is alive, really. Everything is alive. And like the podium or the chair you're sitting in, to put it in a verb form, would be like chairing. Because you're active, you're alive, and the chair is with you, and it's helping you to sit. So it has an aliveness too. But just to think about, that's another sort of, I would say, a real negative with the English language, is very noun and thing focused. And even in the grammar, it's like subject, verb, object. It's like the end point is the object. It's like I'm going to the store to get the thing. It's like to get the milk and to get the dinner. But like, what about the cow that it came from and the people that worked in the field to get the dinner? You know, so there's this whole bigger picture to the language that we lose if we're just thinking in these, you know, nouns and these objects. So that's another, I think, a big thing with trying to enhance, spice up the writing. Oh yeah, I wanted to read it. With all the talk about spicing it up, then I gotta show the simple side too. Sometimes simple is the best. I remember when I did poetry, a lot of poetry stuff in Colorado, there was a guy who wrote this poem, and his name was Clark Smith, and he passed away a few years ago. And but it's just amazing to me that I remember this one line from all the poems. And I remember what he was describing. I think it was something about having gone fishing. And he caught the fish, and then it was something, maybe it was, cooking them over the fire and the campgrounds, but the line was something like, and we cooked the fish, and we ate them, and they were good. And just like the way he said it, like even with the verb to be, and there was no description, it was just, they were good. But the way he said it, it conveyed the experience of like sitting by the fire, and it was good. It was just good. So I present both sides of the spectrum. Another example, this is from a little book, Native American Songs and Poems. It's an anthology by Dover. They have a lot of neat books, but it's another exactly simple, I don't know what time period this is from, but it's an Inuit song. And it's so simple. It's such a good reminder of feeling content, you know, with the complexity of our lives and all the gadgets. This is why I picked this out. The footnote says, whoever the character's name is, he went adrift on the ice while sealing, meaning, I guess, hunting for seal, and only reached shore after a week of hardship. After a week of hardship, and here's the song. I am happy. This is good. There is nothing but ice all around. That is good. For land, we have slush. That is good. I am happy. This is good. When I do not know enough, it is good. When I tire of being awake, I begin to wake. It gives me joy. I just love that. When I do not know enough, it is good. It's like, that should be the motto for the information age. But yeah, it's just such a reminder of the being able to find some peace and contentment amidst even hardship. Yeah, since we're in the poetry place, I want to read, I'll read two more poems, and then if anybody's got questions or whatever. This is one when I would meet my friend, a Native friend who lived out in the woods in Manorville. Buffalo. I don't know, maybe you met him. Tammy met him. I was talking to him once, and I think I might have said, like, oh, it was a nice sunny day, and he said something about, oh, I don't call it the sun. I call it light beings. I was like, what? So, I mean, the short version is, like, you know, we're called human beings, so everything has a beingness to it. Like a tree being, you know, a flower being, the light, you know, light beings. It's like these energies, spirit or whoever is angelic, whatever you want to call it, actual beings that are making up that energy. So I wrote this poem riffing off of that. It's called Buffalo Rising. The dead word stone becomes stone being. The word wood becomes wood being. The sun becomes light beings. Humans grow callous without human being. Hearing in the silence like a refreshing drink of clear water. Do what you like. Busy yourself with distractions if you must, or become active with non-doing. And then, let's see, the one. Yeah, at the end of the empty, moving through the empty gate book, I wanted to write something that kind of summed up everything. So this is what I came up with. And it'll harken back to how I started talking about the letters a bit. Every moment is a gateway to the next moment, fed by the moment before that. Every moment is a potential gateway into another experience. Nothing much happens, a continuous flow, a change in the weather, one's plans. A being enters the physical world, a being leaves the physical world, something breaks, something is mended. One goes inside, one goes outside, one goes nowhere. Go through the eye of the needle. Go through the empty spaces in the A and B. Move beyond the framework, the gatepost outlines of the letters. Every day, move through the mumbo jumbo, the trickster spells entangling the mind and emotions, the propaganda and lies. Move through someone else's word of God. Move through someone else's letter of the law. Move through someone else's hierarchy of A to F to Z. Unravel the bandages of your mummified consciousness. Pull out the nails of your crucifixion into wood from a tree and step lightly with this earth, tethered to starry frequencies. Thank you. That's a lot of stuff. Yeah, you reminded me that was somewhere I read recently. I couldn't find that note, but I think it might be the Hopi language. They said something about they have no present tense. Like, because you think about like anything, like the minute I just said that a second ago, it's no longer that. It's like it's always the present is always what it is. But then if you like sort of get into this mind thing about it, the present is never actually present because every second just went by, so how can you talk about, you know, you can't really get it. So maybe, I think, but then also, I couldn't find my note, but like they have like three or four tenses of language. And one is like healing. It's like we have past, present tense, or different languages, but one of their tenses is healing. So that's another one in like native, we'll say like language, communication is medicine. It's a healing way to, and you think about when you talk with a good friend, or in our Western culture, we go to a therapist, so people go to psychiatrists. That's like a talk is a healing, but not just as like a, to do that on a daily basis and to have that as built into your language, that would probably avoid having to go to the therapist to talk, right? I think that's reflective of the Western culture. We don't have enough that we got to go. You know, it's understandable, but I've done it. You want to find somebody to talk to. there was that, and then the another language. Some of the native languages I've read, like they may have a percentage of all verbs, but another one was there was a lot. They use a lot of adjectives. I forget which one, but somebody mentioned a lot of adjectives, so it wasn't just all the verbs. So I thought that, again, that's interesting and helpful as a writer for how you describe stuff. You know, the adjectives, I find that that's always a way to describe, you know, it was a calm, quiet, this, you know, it was like this, more, you know, that kind of day. But the more adjectives you put in, it creates the feel of what's actually going on, not just, you know, it was a nice day, you know, it's a nice day. Because then who knows what that means. Oh yeah, I wanted to read this one last. I'll read one more. It's poetic. Bruce Colburn, he's one of my favorite singer-songwriters. He's got like 30-something albums. I think he's about 79 years old. He wrote a song about Al Purdy, who was a famous Canadian poet. And it's called Three Al Purdy's. And in the song, he has quotes from the poem. Quote from the Al Purdy poem in the Bruce Colburn song. But this is a nice way to wrap it up, because it's like a beautiful mix of the English and the lettered languages that I've been talking about, and the more organic or animist or indigenous experience. And after the essence of everything had exchanged itself for words and became another being and could even be summoned from the far distance, we chanted a spell of names, and we said, "Mountain, be our friend." And we said, "River, guard us from enemies." And we said what it seemed the gods themselves might say if we had dreamed them. And they had dreamed us from their high places, and they spoke to us in the forest, from the river and the mountain, and the mouths of the ochre painted dead had speech again, and the waters spoke, and the speech had words, and our children remembered. So that's a fitting place to.
Lovely.
And I think the most thing that I got out of this tonight, because you know, even though I planned it, was remembering, you know, what that the state of childlikeness that I think taps into a lot of all this stuff. Because that was Basho's advice. He said, to write good haiku, get a 3-foot child. Mm. It's that wonder. And I remember seeing that when I was in the, you know, little kids grow up, the family that raised, families that raised kids in the house I'm at, and be out there in the yard, and, you know, the first time seeing the garden hose. And they'd be like, the rainbow! Or just the water. I was like, oh my God, the water spray. Or look, there's a rainbow. It's like that amazement as a child is really, I don't know, but I think that could be a formula for any writer. Just if you just have that, I think you could be a decent writer, because that's that wonder, appreciation to grab things and to convey the enthusiasm. Is that, you know, kids have that, and then however much the school system kind of, no offense, Mindy, but
I don't teach the little ones, but
yeah, okay. So you're trying to rehabilitate.
I try to bring them back.
Yeah,
bring them back,
so. But yeah, I think, you know, the schools. I mean, schools can be good. Turn on learning literature and this and that. But you know, a lot of times the language gets forced and structured, and you know, this is the proper way to write an essay, and it's a lack of free form, and now with the AI stuff, and it's like another whole nother realm. But anyway, but thanks so much, and
thanks to
the Long Island Poetry and Literature Repository.